of ash on the other side. Good job, guys. This looks very workable. When will you start, Matt?
Today.
I'll be sending out search parties to make note of locations and potential loot. We have to do this quickly. Aaron says structures won't stay up long once Lincoln gets a rainstorm or two.
Richard raised an eyebrow at Bill.
Turns out ash absorbs water the same way as beach sand. And it doesn't wash off easily, so the absorbed water just adds to the roof loads. Bill shrugged.
Makes sense. I have to stop thinking of the ash as similar to what's left in a fireplace. It's very different.
Once weather starts getting its salvageable items, their value will drop to zero, Matt added.
And once again, we're on a deadline, Richard said.
Outstanding.
54. In the news. This is an NBC News special report. White House officials confirm earlier reports of several terrorist bombings in Washington, D.C. They also acknowledge a number of bombings of government buildings in other states, which they characterize as domestic terrorists attempting to take advantage of the Yellowstone situation. In response, the president announced that he is recalling thousands of military personnel stationed overseas back to the U.S., saying, "Right now, we need to protect our home soil and our citizenry." Civilian air travel has been suspended indefinitely worldwide because of the danger of damage to aircraft engines from volcanic ash. Some countries have also suspended rail service, fearing damage to locomotive engines, moving parts of rolling stock, and even the actual rails. Despite these developments, the White House is downplaying the severity of the eruption, calling the latest USGS assessment premature and ill-advised. "This is not the end of the world," said a spokesman. "This is a volcano. We went through something similar with the eruptions of the Icelandic volcanoes of 2010 and 2014. There were disruptions, there were inconveniences, but we're still here." Dr. Michael Nedman of the USGS could not be reached for comment, and his office stated that he is currently on leave. 55. Explorations. August 1st. Ed Tigerson and Dick Thompson rode up over the top of the low hill, and they could now see the gleaming towers of Rivendell.
"Well, the metal sheds of Rivendell," Dick corrected himself.
The two were doing reconnaissance of the area around the colony on horseback. Experienced riders both, they had jumped at the chance for the outing. They had already completed a circuit roughly a couple of miles radius, crossing Outland's equivalent of Salt Creek twice. Dick had taken notes as one of their duties was to look for a short-term water supply. Now, late in the afternoon, they were returning to Rivendell. Dick hadn't stopped smiling for the entire outing. He explained that back home in New Mexico, he had been able to ride every day. Since going to UNL, he'd desperately missed the feeling of freedom that riding gave him. Ed was more of a dedicated and enthusiastic horseman. The two had spent the day talking and comparing notes.
"Must have been great growing up on a ranch," Dick said. "Your horse always right there, all that space?"
Ed laughed.
"Sure. And if I managed to finish my chores in a reasonable time, I could actually do something about it. We didn't live on a dude ranch, Dick. It was a working property, and we didn't have a bunch of employees to do the work. When I wasn't at school, I was shoveling manure or fixing fences or tending to the cattle and the chickens, on and on, until I was ready to hurl. Meanwhile, other than in school, I very rarely got to see my friends. It's not like I could just walk up the block. My best friend was 5 miles away, and no buses."
Dick thought all that sounded like fun, too, but he was pretty sure that saying so would just encourage another rant. Instead, he said,
"I guess it's one of those grass is greener things. I lived in the city and only got out to my uncle's place on weekends to take care of the horses. I'd have killed to live closer. Honestly, I hated living in the city. Too many people, too busy, traffic everywhere. This right here works for me."
Ed expressed agreement, and they let the subject die. As they rode toward Rivendell in the light of the setting sun, Dick started whistling the Magnificent Seven theme, and Ed laughed out loud. He would never come out and say it, but
this disaster wasn't all downside.
Hey, Zeke, look.
Zeke turned his attention to the direction that Carl pointed. In the distance, he saw horses with riders on them.
Bingo.
Zeke was gratified that his logic had been correct. The kids, or someone, had set up somewhere else and probably somewhere close. He looked at his watch. Late afternoon.
We have to be close to high ground before dark. We'll need to try to spot their camp. Hopefully they'll have lights up or fires or something.
I'm not thrilled with spending the whole night in a tree, so we'd better have our own fire ready.
Fair enough, but make sure it's out of sight. We don't want them discovering us.
Zeke reasoned that given the time of day, the riders were more likely headed back to their camp rather than away from it. With that in mind, the two took off in the same direction as the riders. As dusk fell, they decided that they couldn't afford to put off setting up their own camp any longer. They had, by necessity, become fast experts on the whole process. They found a reasonable spot, gathered fuel for their fire, and laid everything out. Before they lit the fire, Zeke examined the darkened sky.
There,
he said, pointing. The faint glow on the horizon had nothing to do with a setting sun or rising moon. Zeke made a point of poking a couple of sticks into the ground to indicate the direction. Then they turned to their camp and set up for the night. 56. In the news.
This is the BBC World Service. Today, without warning, the satellite broadcasts for all of the major American television networks dropped out. A spokesperson for 10 Downing Street tells BBC News it would take a large infrastructure collapse for all transmission sources to be simultaneously cut off in this manner. It is reasonable to suspect deliberate planning was involved. There were labor riots again today in France as workers expressed concern over possible loss of employment entitlements caused by the impending economic contraction. There are credible reports that Iran is preparing to invade Iraq on the tail of the U.S. withdrawal from the Middle East. Satellite images show massive troop movements toward the Iran-Iraq border. And there have been a number of large explosions in Israeli towns along the West Bank. A spokesman for Hamas threatened the obliteration of the State of Israel, quote, "Now that they no longer have their powerful protector to rely on," Israel responded by stating, "Any attack on the State of Israel will result in retaliation. We will deliver unacceptable levels of damage to any aggressor."
57. News from Earthside. Bill looked up as Richard stepped into the east shed and stood there, blinking as his eyes adjusted to the dim light.
"Over here, big guy."
"Hey, Bill, what did you want to talk to me about?"
"Oh, nothing much. Just..."
Bill turned a monitor around with a flourish.
"Satellite TV?"
Right there in front of them, BBC News was playing.
"Cross-dimensional TV reception? Bill, I'm impressed."
Richard's face was a mix of surprise and pleasure.
"Okay, but seriously, that's not possible. How are you doing this?"
Bill tried and failed to look humble.
"Well, it's being received by a hacked satellite decoder, so it's technically pirated, but on the scale of events lately, I can't really get upset about that. To answer your question, I'm receiving the broadcast live through that."
He pointed to his left at a small satellite dish that was aimed through the 3-foot gate. A sliver of gray, ash-filled sky showed through the gate's aperture, and a clear plastic sheet stretched across the opening, blocking the ash that was still falling on Earthside.
"So you're picking up Earthside satellite broadcasts through the gate?"
"Yep. Turn on the gate, aim the dish through it, and we can receive dozens of channels. It took a while to line up the dish and gate with the satellite's Earthside, but now we can get the news whenever we want. As long as they keep transmitting, anyway."
"What's that supposed to mean?" Richard asked.
"I watched this for about 20 minutes before I sent someone to find you. Things are way the hell worse Earthside than anyone expected. I don't want to start a general panic. I was thinking maybe we could get the gate owners together and talk about it.
Richard's eyebrows rose at Bill's somber pronouncement. Okay, turn it off for now and let's go find the rest of our group. We can discuss it when we're all together.
The group agreed to meet at the far end of the compound. While he waited, Bill watched the livestock, deep in thought. The animals were herded outside the fenced area for part of each day so they could graze. The grazing was very good in this version of Earth, so the livestock seemed happy. Guards with guns mounted on ATVs and horses made sure that the local predators didn't get any ideas. A couple of confrontations with wolf packs had ended badly for the wolves, and they now avoided the area. As the last person showed up, Monica as usual, Richard said,
"This is really Bill's meeting, so I'll lob it to him."
He made a tossing motion to Bill. "I wish I had a movie reference or something to cut the tension a little, but I'm coming up blank today. Bottom line, things are going to hell Earthside. They're saying now that Yellowstone pumped well over 700 cubic miles of crud into the atmosphere." Erin gasped in horror. Bill gave her an apologetic palms up before continuing. "It also pumped the crud higher into the upper atmosphere than any normal volcano has ever done, so the fallout is going to be more widespread, and the very fine ejecta is going to stay aloft a lot longer." He looked down for a second. "Plus, of course, Homo moronus has to make a bad situation worse. Some countries have declared their intent to stop exporting food and oil, so other countries are threatening to go in and take it. Israel's enemies have taken the opportunity to attack when its allies are on their knees, and you know how well Israel takes that kind of thing. The BBC says nukes have been used."
Bill took a beat to look around, trying to keep his composure.
"Russia appears to be invading a bunch of nearby countries to ensure ongoing supplies. China has closed its borders completely and severed all communications with anybody whatsoever. Africa is mostly self-destructing. Oh, and have I mentioned, Washington appears to have fallen. Near as I can tell, the government is operating out of an undisclosed location, and at least three other governments have popped up and declared independence. I'm pretty sure the United States doesn't exist as a nation anymore, guys."
Bill looked at his friends. Haunted faces looked back at him.
"But," Kevin said, "it's only been a week. By most estimates, most cities only have 3 days' worth of food and supplies," Aaron replied. "There's also a common truism that people are 9 meals away from anarchy. Same math, really. Add to that the fact that the ash will clog and foul all open water, which includes most reservoirs, and by now, any machinery that operates out in open air has died. Coal is no longer being delivered for coal-powered electrical plants. Wind turbines will have seized up. Hydro dams either have or soon will. Even nuclear plants require a steady supply of clean water. So for a significant fraction of the continent, no more electricity. Desperation is setting in, and that means trouble."
Bill interrupted Aaron's explanation.
"One of the things you didn't catch earlier, Richard, was that I was tuned to the BBC. That's because there are no longer any American stations on the satellite feed. No Fox, no CNN, no MSNBC. I've managed to get something from Western Canada, but they aren't having a wonderful time either. Some of the European feeds have dropped out, but I can still get more than half of them. There's very little coming from anything south of the equator."
He finished with a bleak expression on his face.
"I think we might be on our own, guys."
Richard turned to Aaron. "What do you think that volcanic crud figure will mean for the planet?"
"It means that enough is going to get across the equator to send both hemispheres into perpetual winter for a number of years. Far worse than with any of the previous supervolcanoes. It means there will be more ash over a wider area, killing more ecosystems. The human race is probably going to experience a severe dieback.
How bad? Erin opened her mouth to reply, then stopped and shook her head.
Wow, this is really turning into a baptism of fire. All those classes I was taking, suddenly everything is life and death, and I have to get it right the first time. Adulting is hard.
She blinked and hesitated again.
Okay, look, everything I know about these situations is based on historical eruptions, but none of those were on this scale, and I don't know how well I can extrapolate. If anything, this will probably be proportionally worse, so take all of this with a grain of salt. The problem with volcanoes isn't just the eruption itself. The subsequent loss of economic and industrial capability, combined with ecosystem collapse, often affects far more people when total casualties are added up. Based on that, I think I can justify an estimate of several hundred million victims, at minimum. And that doesn't count deaths from wars. Then starvation will take the global population down to pre-industrial levels over the next several years.
There were more shocked looks. Billions of people might be dead before this was over. 58. Salvage Operations. August 3rd. Bill looked around the group spread out in front of him. A number of late volunteers had swollen the numbers of the scavenging team until Matt now commanded the largest single department in the Rivendell government, if it could be called that, as of yet. Very probably a lot of these volunteers were more interested in getting a look back home than anything else. That was fine, though. They'd look. Then they'd either quit or they'd get on with business, and they would return to Rivendell with news and descriptions for everyone else. Matt stepped forward and waited until the buzz of conversation had died down.
All right, folks. Your group leaders have a copy of the wish lists from the department heads. Keep an eye out for those items, but really make a note of anything that looks to be in one piece. Include street location and GPS coordinates if you can. Also watch for heavy equipment with available keys, including but not limited to trucks, especially diesel, since that's the fuel we'll be depending on long term. But make sure it's not sitting there because it broke down. He scanned the group and instructed them. Remember to keep your masks and goggles on at all times. The main ash has settled out by now and Yellowstone has slowed down, but the fine particulates will still be in the air until Lincoln gets some rain. Even that will be enough to give you a really bad case of silicosis.
Matt gestured to Bill and stepped back. Bill paused to scan the group one more time, then began.
One item we could really use is deep cycle batteries. If you see any place stocking them, report it immediately. Otherwise, look for caravans and RVs, motorized wheelchairs, electric forklifts, and other warehouse equipment, and golf carts. They all use this type of battery. And if you find an auto parts shop with alternators in boxes, report that too.
On top of everything else on the list? Matt asked.
Yeah, I know. Everything's a priority. Except, joking aside, it really is.
Bill sighed and handed the control tablet to Charlie, one of Matt's crew. They needed more people able to operate the gates, and Charlie seemed to be an organized sort. Matt was already using him as an unofficial second-in-command for the group. Charlie poked at a few controls, and the gate faded in, showing the exterior of the warehouse. Without a word, the scavenger crews began tromping through the gate. Matt walked over to a table they'd set up on the prairie grass and began inspecting a map of Lincoln. He drew a rough circle around the warehouse location and turned to Bill.
That's about the limit for walking distance exploration. We'll have to take my truck out farther afield on this side to set up future expeditions.
Hopefully they can find you another truck or two. Being completely dependent on your vehicle is not going to work long term. It's gas-fueled.
And kind of small.
Bill chuckled.
I can't believe you just said that. I think you love that truck more than you do Erin.
Matt smiled back.
Don't let Erin hear you say that.
Kurt, Susie, and Bruno eyed the Home Depot uncertainly. It was an obvious first stop in the hunt for useful items, but the roof appeared to have already collapsed. At least, partly.
"That's kind of weird," Kurt said, his voice muffled by the dust mask. "That roof is definitely lower than it should be, but it's not flattened. Ideas?"
Bruno shrugged.
"Speculation is useless. Let's go look."
"After you,"
Bruno replied with an exaggerated, condescending bow and headed for the front doors. The glass appeared to have been blown outward, possibly by the forces of the collapse. He came out a minute later.
"Home Depot really knows how to build. The roof did collapse, but all those huge steel shelves that they use acted as supports. The inventory on the top level is toast, or maybe pancakes, but we can move around in the aisles."
The trio entered and had a quick look around.
"Lots of useful salvage in here," Susie said. "Maybe not so much the appliances."
Kurt laughed.
"Bill Rustad, remember? King of the Rube Goldberg? He'll find a use for those."
"Let's check outside, in the yard," Bruno said.
They circled the building and came to the open-air part of the store, where the roof had also collapsed onto the shelving units. They wandered a bit until they found the fencing supplies. There were large stocks of fence posts and roll after roll of metal fencing and barbed wire.
"Cool," Kurt said.
"One last thing, post hole digger. Anyone know where the rental office is?"
"We passed it on the way around, oh blind one," Susie replied.
"It looked locked. We may have to borrow a 10-pound lockpick."
"Right. I'll radio Matt and let him know. Who's got the GPS?"
Phil and Pete had volunteered to check out some nearby gas stations. Both had worked as gas jockeys while in school, so they knew their way around. As soon as the scavenging parties had crossed over, the pair headed for a nearby Shell station. It looked like it had been abandoned in a hurry after the earthquake. Things hadn't even been locked up. Phil knew how to use the dipstick to check the contents of the tanks. This took perhaps 10 minutes, including the time to clean the area around the access port. Having found a supply of gasoline and diesel that would last the colony for months, the two decided that this called for a break. Pete patted his jacket pocket and Phil nodded in agreement. They had done their duty. They would report their find, cross over to Outland, and experience better living through botany.
"You were shot at?"
Matt's eyes grew wide as the group gesticulated and tried to all talk at once.
"I think it was warning shots," Susie yelled over her two teammates. "Either that or someone has incredibly bad aim. They were yelling at us to stop. Seriously, does anyone ever actually stop because they're being shot at?"
"Bruno here passed me like I was out for a stroll," Kurt said.
"Fear lends wings, brother."
"Yeah, but..."
"Wings, I say."
Matt held up a hand to get their attention.
"Did they identify themselves? Did you get a look at them?"
"Nope," Susie said. "We were too busy heading for the gate and yelling at Charlie to be ready to pull the plug."
"Well, isn't that just peachy?" Matt grumbled. "This will put a crimp in things. We've either got competitors or law enforcement trying to shut us down. Richard will have a shit."
59. High Council. Matt hung his head, pinching the top of his nose with thumb and forefinger. It took several seconds before other people began to notice. The yelling and arguing dribbled to a stop. Matt looked up into the awkward silence.
"I quit,"
Richard grinned at him.
"Welcome to politics. If you quit, I quit too."
"Sorry, Matt,"
Krista said.
"We know you're not being deliberately obstructionist or anything. It's just..."
"I know. Everyone needs their items now. And each one of you has a good reason. But we've got someone shooting at us. I can't ask my crew to go walkies in Lincoln with that happening."
"I understand," Richard said. "But the team had actually loaded up, right?"
"Yeah. They found
a hardware store and had grabbed some items, batteries, flashlights, camp stoves, and so on. They had to drop it all, of course.
Which leaves us still up in the air. Could be law enforcement trying to prevent looting, or could be some other group trying to rob us.
The solution, Bill said, is to work more from this side. Pop over only to retrieve stuff, and only indoors if at all possible.
But we're victims of our own success, Matt said. We found so many locations worth looting, salvaging, except no drivable vehicles. So until we can find some more trucks, without searching from that side, mind you, we're going to be limited to walking distance on this side, or whatever we can manage with my F-150, which raises a whole other set of problems. We end up with a trail of predators looking for a chance to pick off a stray human.
Right. That means vehicles become a priority, said Bill.
Krista started to sputter, and Richard balled his fists.
I quit.
Yeah, sure you do, Ed replied. Should we start breaking into houses looking for keys? Richard shook his head. Not a good idea, Ed. People either took their vehicles when they got out of town, or they're probably still home. Try to break in, and you might find yourself at the wrong end of a shotgun.
Not to mention the ethical and legal issues.
I think we're a little past worrying about that. This is a survival situation, but if it helps, if we run into someone, we'll offer to take them in. That counts for something, right?
Silence greeted Richard's comments, so he continued. Look, maybe we should concentrate on this problem for the moment. Matt, see if you can round up info on the locations of car dealerships. They'll have demo vehicles, and keys should be in the offices somewhere. Once we have a few trucks, it will take the pressure off.
Matt nodded slowly.
My crew has been watching for people, police, army, or other emergency personnel. We still got taken by surprise. It'd be nice to get them on our side, whoever they are.
If they're legit and not another group of looters, Bill replied.
We're not.
Technically, we are.
Let's go with the assumption that they will shoot us.
Richard held up a hand to forestall the argument. Okay, we understand, but honestly, if we run into actual army or National Guard, we could just invite them over, right?
I think their policy is shoot first, though, Richard sighed.
I've got nothing else for you, Bill. We either continue on this path or we stop right now and take our chances with what we already have. Honestly, if we have to stay here over the winter, I don't think we'll survive without a lot more supplies.
Over the winter? Krista glared at Richard. Just how long-term are we talking about anyway?
Aaron, who had been quiet up to this point, spoke up.
Other than the shooting incident, no one saw any movement, from what Matt says. Everyone is either already out of town or they've dug in somewhere. And as I keep pointing out, if they've gone out and been breathing the ash, they'll be dead within another week anyway. The ash is several feet deep, with deeper drifts. You won't be driving on it, and even if you get some monster truck, there's still enough fine particulates in the air to destroy an engine. Power is out, communication towers will have collapsed by now, dishes will be buried, so no phone and no internet.
Aaron crossed her arms and sat back, looking discouraged.
If FEMA is involved, they'll be concentrating on setting up refugee camps outside the edge of the ash cloud, and honestly, chances are that line keeps moving as they pull back. Yellowstone isn't finished spewing, and the cloud is still being pushed into the stratosphere faster than it can get out of the way, so it'll continue to be pushed outward even after the volcano settles down. They may not be able to move refugees fast enough to get them to safety.
Krista closed her eyes and groaned. Aaron spread her hands, palms up.
Krista, as primitive and frontier-like as this is, it's at least livable. If we can collect enough supplies and equipment to keep our overly civilized asses alive until we can adapt.
Look, Richard said, this is something we put off discussing at our first meeting. Maybe it's time to clear the air on this and let everyone else know exactly where we stand based on what we've learned since then.
All eyes turned to Aaron. She consulted some notes, then looked around the table.
Yellowstone has been spewing ash and smoke for more than a week now. I could say the worst is over, but that's only a relative statement. Several more satellite channels have dropped out, but we're still getting good coverage from the European broadcasters, including the BBC. Total ash ejections are estimated at up to 800 cubic miles to this point. That already puts us over any other supervolcano eruption except Wawa Springs, which was about 30 million years ago. Unless Yellowstone experiences a fresh eruption, that number probably won't dramatically increase. But everything that goes into the atmosphere now pushes all the dust and ash already there outward. By this point, it's probably covering most of North America, and it's pushing across the equatorial interface, so the southern hemisphere is going to get hammered too. I've already talked about fatalities from breathing the dust. I've already talked about damage to any equipment with moving parts from the dust. Now, we have to deal with the volcanic equivalent of a nuclear winter.
Oh, come on, seriously? Ed said. Aaron glared at him.
In 1815, Mount Tambora in Indonesia erupted. It produced what is commonly called the Year Without a Summer in 1816 in North America and Europe. And lots of other places, of course, but those are the locations we get our history from. The point, though, is that Tambora affected climate half a world away. Snow in the middle of summer, massive crop failures, death tolls in the tens of thousands in the British Isles, and the punchline? Tambora was estimated at somewhere in the range of 12 cubic miles of ejecta, depending on who you listen to. That's about a percent or two of what Yellowstone has put out so far. I can't put it any more clearly than this. The Earth and the human race is completely fucked.
Aaron blushed as she finished. Richard knew her well enough by now to realize how upset she had to be to resort to obscenities. Krista sighed into the silence.
That's the comment about being here for a while. Krista, I could be massively overestimating this. As I keep saying, all my estimates are based on classroom review of historical eruptions, plus what I've learned about supervolcanoes. The news channels could be inflating the numbers, who knows, but I think we have to plan for the worst case.
Bill put up a hand to get the floor.
Okay, scavenging is fine for the short term, but if we are looking at long-term residents, then we need to start planning for the time when scavenging is no longer useful. Gas will start to go bad. Things like medicines and antibiotics will expire. Canned food will run out, and perishable food will go bad. Corrosion and weathering will start taking out buildings and machinery. Eventually, we have to become completely self-reliant.
And try to avoid sliding back into the Stone Age, Krista said. Things like medical knowledge will have to be preserved. We don't have enough of a population to be able to afford to go back to medieval death rates from things like infections or childbirth.
That seals it, Richard declared. We owe it to everyone to come clean. And we all need to make some decisions. A short time later, Richard looked over the crowd. Some were stunned into silence, their eyes glazed. Others sobbed openly. One person had exchanged a few heated words with another, then punched him. Bystanders had ended it by sitting on the attacker. One man stood, yelling at Richard. It wasn't coherent enough to make out specifics, but Richard thought the gist was that he blamed Richard and his friends for all of it. A few people were attempting to shout him down, pointing out very reasonably that the gate owners had saved them and had not caused the catastrophe.
How do we know that? The heckler countered. How do we know that they didn't cause it?
How do we know you didn't cause it? Another voice yelled.
What?
The heckler said, momentarily derailed.
Maybe you are responsible, the second voice continued. Or maybe it was leprechauns, or maybe Santa Claus got tired of delivering presents every year, as long as we're flinging around stupid, baseless accusations.
The heckler stood for a few seconds more, his mouth working like a fish trying to breathe. Then he put his head down, balled his fists, slowly sat down, and covered his face with his hands. There were a few seconds of sympathetic silence. Richard spoke in what he hoped was a reasonable voice.
Look, we're going to have to take this a day at a time. At least we have options. We can always return Earthside if we decide it's safe. Meanwhile, this place is at least livable. Bottom line, though, we are probably going to be here a long time. We have to stop treating this like a camping trip or summer retreat and start thinking long term.
With you guys in charge the whole time?
Richard looked in the direction of the shout but couldn't pick out the speaker.
No. Everyone has to be in on this, which means everyone has to be involved, which means elections and rules and jobs and maybe eventually an economy. We'll start by...
And what if we don't agree to that?
Richard looked to his right, where Bill was slowly shaking his head.
Probably the same assholes,
Bill commented quietly. Richard turned back to face the crowd and allowed some irritation into his voice.
Nothing's keeping you here. You can always leave and form your own, whatever it is you think will work, or go back to Lincoln.
And what if we don't feel like leaving?
Oh, for fuck's sake, look, whoever you are, you might think you can just plant your feet and act stubborn and no one will be able to do anything. And that might have worked back home, where you could run to social media and play the victim. But here, we're in a survival situation, and we don't have time for this kind of bullshit. We'll get a bunch of people together and toss you over the fence and invite you to start walking, or push you through the gate back to Earthside. You accept the group decision, or you get out.
I don't recognize your right to make those decisions.
I don't give even a tiny fraction of a fuck what you do or do not recognize. I've given you your choices.
Richard waited, but there was no response. It was doubtful that he'd persuaded the speaker of anything. More likely, whoever it was would just agitate again later. Richard spotted Monica moving through the crowd and smiled to himself. Things wouldn't go well for Mr. Anarchy if he kept pushing it.
Time to wrap this up. We're slightly over 300 people now, with the latest refugees. Bill thinks we can get a PA from one of the locations we've earmarked. At that point, we'll have a town hall meeting. For now, my voice is done.
He gave a wave to cheers, jeers, and shouted commentary. Richard turned as Bill gestured to see Monica stomping up to their group. Monica had always had a determined air about her, but he noted idly that this gait was becoming habitual. He wondered what would happen if someone didn't jump out of her way fast enough. Nothing good, certainly.
His name's Adam Velichkov, she said as she came to a stop. Several people recognized him. He's a general loudmouth, frequents the political groups and rallies, and always seems to be at odds with everyone. Always shit-disturbing. No one had anything good to say about him. He seems to be a professional troublemaker. No one knows what his major is, or even if he has one.
Great, so he's going to be a problem, Richard said. We'll have to deal with that when we get to it.
It probably won't be just him, Monica replied. He was with a couple of friends, and it's worth noting that none of them were the two loudmouths who were hassling Bill that first day, so we've got at least five assholes.
Things were getting pretty heated this last semester with all the political rallies on campus, Bill said. There are already bad feelings, and I'll bet real money people won't leave that behind.
Shit.
Richard rubbed his chin and thought.
Bill, as time goes on, I'm finding myself moving closer to your point of view. It's time to use your paranoia superpower again. Please discuss this with Monica and Fred offline. We need to be ready for the possibility that someone is going to try something underhanded.
Got it,
Monica turned to Bill.
We'll need to talk about available gate and portal equipment as well.
Monica rolled her eyes.
Come on, Captain Paranoid, keep up. We need to make sure the equipment is secure so it can't get grabbed, and frankly, I'd like to have some spares that no one knows about.
Looks like we've got our work cut out for us, Bill said.
60. Sunny days. August 5th. The sun was out again today in Rivendell. Aaron and Monica had decided to take a much-needed break. As they lay on a couple of cheap aluminum beach chairs, no doubt salvaged from some summer accessories store, Aaron mentally reviewed the last 10 days or so. The colony had adapted quickly. They'd implemented a routine of 2 meals a day, breakfast and dinner. A lot of people were having trouble with that, though. Aaron chuckled at the thought. A lot of people were having trouble with a lack of snacks, and truthfully, a lot of people would be better off without them. Aaron had volunteered to work the breakfast shift, and for once there wasn't a council meeting scheduled today, so she was technically free until dinner.
I wonder what we'll make, Aaron thought. Venison chili? Or maybe buffalo chili? Or maybe buffalo burgers without the buns? Or buffalo steaks? Or venison steaks?
Aaron found herself mentally reviewing various council discussions, a new habit that she couldn't seem to shake. One of the first things that the scavenging parties had gone looking for was food, and unfortunately, that was the one thing that every other resident of Lincoln had also gone looking for after the eruption. Short of breaking into individual homes, there was very little food left to be found, Earthside. That left the supplies that Bill had originally purchased, plus anything that could be acquired on this side. They were in no danger of starving to death, but there would be adjustments. They'd managed to coax the chickens into an egg-laying routine, but a dozen eggs a day for a couple hundred people wouldn't go very far. So, instead, they were going to hatch as many of the eggs as they could to try to build up the inventory. In addition to their obvious duties, the two roosters had become the colony's alarm clocks and the most hated denizens of Rivendell. Meanwhile, breakfast very much resembled dinner, except for the location of the sun in the sky. The Aggie students had located wild herbs and onions and a couple of other vegetable-ish plants, so there was at least some variety to the meals. Someone said that they had recovered some seeds from a couple of businesses Earthside and would be trying to grow some late summer crops. That would help as well. Aaron sighed.
Low-carb diet, no problem now.
She lay in the lawn chair, enjoying the feeling of warmth, refusing to let herself be consumed by the food situation. As on most days, the sky was not completely clear. Clouds were always scudding through, the fluffy kind of clouds that would block the sun for a few minutes at a time. She looked around. There were a couple of dozen people sitting or lying down on the folding beach chairs, including that Josh character who never seemed to be working. Aaron laughed a bit. Monica opened her eyes and turned to her.
What's funny? Oh, I was just looking around. This place is such a weird mix of Wild West pioneer and modern suburbia. We're sitting in these chairs suntanning while people are riding around on horses hunting and other people race around on dirt bikes. Meanwhile, there's a crew digging latrines, another hauling water, while yet another crew uses an interdimensional portal to go raiding another universe for supplies. It's bizarre. I wonder if they'll make a movie out of it, or a TV series. Bill would like that,
Monica sighed.
I guess that's not very likely right now, is it? Maybe not this month, but things might improve.
Aaron looked up. A couple of guys were coming over, carrying folding chairs. She saw it was Pete and Phil.
Hello, ladies, Pete said as they unfolded the chairs. Aaron smiled at them in greeting, and Monica gave them a cheerful hello. Some men were relentless and had to be fended off constantly, but Pete and Phil were harmless and easygoing. They just wanted to find a way to slack off.
So what are you guys working on these days? Aaron asked.
Scouting, Phil said. We kind of used up all our talents on the scavenging end of things when we found the fuel at the gas station.
They'll probably call on us again, but meanwhile our job is to ride around on dirt bikes.
So why aren't you out there today?
Al broke one of the dirt bikes, Pete replied. He's fixing it right now, and Richard told him he's cut off for a week. Al is some pissed.
The dude is insane, Phil added. Dirt biking is his main thing in life. I think they're planning on doing a scavenging expedition to his home at some point to pick up all his toys, including all his bikes. Then he can break those instead of the colony's bikes.
There's so much stuff we need, Pete mused. It seems like every 5 minutes someone is asking Matt to arrange an expedition to get some other thing. He wants to go hit auto dealerships and scavenge some vehicles so they can grab more things at once, but he can't get people to leave him alone long enough.
They let the silence stretch for a few minutes. There was no feeling of awkwardness, nor need to fill the quiet with chatter. The warmth and slight breeze melted away any feeling of urgency. Erin felt herself start to drift.
You guys think we'll ever get back to civilization? Phil's voice brought Erin back from the brink.
Honestly?
Pete answered before Erin or Monica could reply. I couldn't care less if we never do. This made Erin open one eye and look at him.
Really?
Yeah, Pete said. Mind you, ask me again in a month when we've gone through our stash, but I'm not sure we aren't better off now. Earth was getting way too complicated, crowded, and stressed. I know we're going to miss some things eventually, but right now I feel like if I had a button in front of me to bring the old world back, I wouldn't press it.
Maybe you should talk to the agro folks, Monica said. I'm sure your stash has some seeds in it.
Pete and Phil both sat up straight and looked at each other.
Son of a bitch, Pete said.
They leapt off their chairs and went charging off with a, "Watch our stuff!" yelled back to the girls.
You sure know how to clear a room,
Erin said. Monica took a bow from her chair. 61. Mealtime. August 6th.
Wow, what a friggin' day.
Bill lowered himself into the lawn chair with a groan and arranged his plate on his lap. Mealtimes had become routine, but there was a large flavor of camping in the process. Kitchen volunteers cooked the meals in some impressively large pots that had been rescued from a restaurant Earthside in the first couple of days. Other kitchen staff served the food cafeteria style. People lined up, then found a spot on the lawn, as the fenced-off area was now called, and sat down to eat. Monica glanced at Bill, then returned her attention to her plate of something chili stew. He looked down at his own plate and considered the contents. Hunting had turned out to be like shooting fish in a barrel. The local wildlife was plentiful and unacquainted with the concept of weapons that could kill at a distance. As such, there was no shortage of food, and the food was healthier than the average pre-eruption diet had been. But a vegetarian would have had a hard time. Animal protein figured prominently, and most people didn't even ask anymore. It was something stew again. A movement caught Bill's eye, and he looked up to see Pete and Phil approaching. The stoners could be depended on to never miss a meal, and they sometimes made for some hilarious conversation. Monica, in particular, seemed to like them, probably because they didn't give a crap what anyone thought of them. The two sat down, plates delicately balanced in one hand, nodded greetings to everyone, and started to dig in. And lastly, Richard arrived and settled down. Bill noticed once again that the blonde in the next group over always seemed to be very aware of Richard's arrival.
I wonder if I can encourage that somehow.
I miss bread, Richard said out of nowhere.
Eh? Bill was surprised. Richard was usually all business, even at mealtimes.
Bread. Buns. Sandwiches. Amazing what trivial things you suddenly get a twinge about.
Erin smiled.
I know, I never thought I'd find myself wishing for more vegetables. My mom would have a laughing fit if she heard me.
At the mention of her mom, Erin's face fell. Silence settled over the group as each person went through similar emotions.
Changing the subject, Matt asked Richard,
"How are things in committee?"
"Same old. Too many things to do, not enough time or resources. Bill's comment about preparing for the long haul just adds an additional layer of complication." He looked over at Monica. "Any progress on Operation Shenanigans?" Monica grinned at the bemused expressions from the others, then replied,
"We can only do so much without some specific threat, of course, but we're making progress."
She inclined her head slightly in the direction of Phil and Pete. The message was clear, not for public discussion.
"Are we still going to be here next year?" Pete asked. His plate empty, he'd finally come up for air.
Monica shrugged and motioned to Bill. Because he watched the satellite broadcasts more than anyone else did, Bill had become the de facto expert on Earthside status. Bill lay back, supporting himself on his elbows.
"I think we'll be here a little longer than that, Pete. Things are still spiraling downward Earthside, and they aren't going to stop doing so for a while.
The ash from the eruption has halted most forms of transportation, which means no food deliveries, no fuel deliveries, and no travel. The only resource available to survivors are what's within walking distance. Most urban areas don't have much in the way of food-producing industries close by, so once the supplies in the supermarkets are used up, people will start migrating to look for food. That'll be generally south, although south of Yellowstone is a bad bet. One of the things I picked up a while back was that Mexico has closed its border to the American exodus, and yes, they're being deliberately retaliatory. The bottom line is that there's now a much smaller percentage of land on the planet that's suitable for producing food, at the same time that our technical ability to sustain intensive high-yield agriculture is disappearing. Add to that the fact that there's not much left in the way of fish and wildlife to harvest in our modern world, you can see where it's going to go.
Why can't we bring more people across to this side? Phil said.
Well, we could if we could get to them, Richard replied. The thing is, Phil, on Earthside, probably everyone will have left Nebraska by now. In fact, within about 1,500 miles of Yellowstone, you could probably go days without seeing another human being. As Bill said, they've all migrated looking for food, other than the occasional individual or family that we've managed to find.
In order to find survivors to bring across, we'd have to travel, east, west, north, whatever. And the highways are probably full of broken-down vehicles that people attempted to use in the middle of the worst ashfall. So, how do we get to California, for instance?
Phil thought about this for a few seconds, then sighed and hung his head.
And that isn't the worst of it, Bill added.
There's more?
Phil looked like he regretted asking.
See, the eruption will knock civilization back to a pre-industrial or early industrial level. Eventually, the ash will clear and ecosystems will start to recover, but then what? Humanity has been intensively extracting all the coal, metals, and oil from the earth for a long time now. We've taken out the easily accessible resources, the moderately accessible resources, and in the last 50 years or so, we've been attacking the deeply buried stuff that can only be gotten at with high technology. When things start to recover, you'll have a pre-industrial society with no access to any of the raw resources that we had lying around the first time around. No coal, no oil, no huge untouched forests, no surface deposits of any kind of metal. Humanity will never recover on Earthside. There's nothing left to recover with.
That was the final straw. Phil picked up his plate, got up, and left, followed by Pete.
Damn, that's bleak, Matt said. Bill sat up and rubbed his forehead. Phil's right, though. In the longer term, we have to go looking for people. We have to bring them across, and we have to start again on this side. There's simply no other option.
62. Plan of Attack. It was a long way from the trees to the camp in the distance, but Zeke could make out the general activity, which included a lot of coming and going. Occasionally, small groups would drive off on ATVs or dirt bikes.
We have to get some of those weapons, Carl said. We're outgunned right now and almost out of ammo. They'd been going around and around on this for days.
I don't see how we can get close enough to take them out by hand, Zeke replied. I don't want to tip off the camp with gunfire, and we can't just set up way far away and hope they'll show up to be mugged.
Dirt bikes make noise, Carl commented. Can we use that as cover somehow?
Good point, Carl. We still have to wait for them to slow or stop, but I think the engines will drown out any noise from our pea shooters.
Zeke smiled tightly, happy that they'd come up with an idea, and happier that it would allow him to shoot someone. Zeke would never describe himself as peaceful. He tended to view violence as a reasonable negotiating tactic, and he enjoyed it. But with these kids, it was personal. They'd outsmarted him and left him to die sometime in the past. He'd been cold. He'd been rained on. He was always hungry. Jimmy was dead, and it was all their fault.
Little bastards are going to pay, Zeke muttered. They're going to pay for Jimmy. They're going to pay for what they did to me. They're going to pay for making me sleep in a tree.
63. Scavenging. August 7th. The scavenging group slogged through the university grounds on Earth, hunched forward, heads down. There was no longer any detectable ash in the air, and recent rains had turned the ash on the ground into a gummy mess up to a foot deep with the consistency of soft clay. This had the desirable effect of allowing them to take off the breathing masks and prevented ash clouds rising from their footsteps, but made those same footsteps much more difficult. The three were sweating from the walk, and it was not a hot day. In fact, Kurt couldn't decide how to describe the current weather. He'd read a short story once titled Becalmed in Hell. The only details he remembered were the title and floating in a gray mist, and that seemed to be very appropriate for the current conditions. The sky was gray, not from clouds, not from overcast. The sky itself looked gray, as if blue had been deleted from the color spectrum. A brighter patch indicated where the sun must be, but there was no texture visible there either. The ash, caked onto everything, leached the color out of the landscape and left nothing but a dull, brownish gray. The air was cool and still, but far more humid than seemed possible for the temperature. Kurt felt he couldn't get a breath, even though from moment to moment his body was getting enough oxygen. The group had been given a list of buildings to check out and report on. They were currently making their way to the Scott Engineering Center. Kurt had started humming the Volga boat song, but gave it up after a minute as too much effort. No one commented. Private Andrews watched the figures moving across the campus in the distance. He lowered the binoculars and turned to Private Timmonson, who had cleared a space on a low wall and was sitting down.
They've got guns, but they're not doing anything illegal. No real need to pursue, right?
Timmonson grimaced.
I'm not moving for anything short of the crack of doom. Another crack of doom, I mean, they both grunted, neither having the strength to spare for actual laughter.
This is like a cold, clammy version of hell.
Andrews made a note of date, time, location, and description of the subjects for his report, adding, no evidence that these are looters, pursuit not indicated. He put away the logbook and settled himself, trying to find a more comfortable position without actually sitting in crusted ash.
We don't need more mouths to feed anyway. I don't know why we haven't started moving the civilians out of town by now.
Sure you do, because we can't, Timmonson said. You heard what the professor said about trying to drive on the highways. Do you really want to end up trying to get to Fort Leonard Wood on foot?
Assuming they haven't also bugged out.
Yeah. Couple more days, we can start getting radio comms again and we'll know better. Meanwhile,
Timmonson waved in the general direction of the figures they'd observed.
Chavez says recon, we recon.
Matt took a deep breath and let it out slowly. He turned to the rest of the group.
Yeah, it's a bit dangerous. We have to try, though. If there are any surviving pockets in there, it would be a major score.
They were standing in front of a supermarket. As was all too common with this style of building, the roof had collapsed under the weight of the ash. The collapse had been uneven rather than the entire roof pancaking, so the scavengers decided to check for any non-crushed pockets. Matt and a few others were earthside, providing an outside perspective via walkie-talkie to another team, which was pole-camming the inside of the supermarket from outland. Finally, the radio crackled and a voice announced, "We found an open area. Looks like loads of salvageable items, definitely cans of food at least." Matt and his group whooped, and there were high fives all around. A few minutes later, the 6-foot gate opened up, and the Outland team walked through into the supermarket. It took hours to unload the open section. No one complained, though. They found not only cans and jars of food, but also flour, sugar, powdered milk, dried pasta, and boxes and bags of cereal. The crew was euphoric. The haul would mean weeks' worth of meals free from chili, and months' worth of meals with some added variety. Timmonson looked at the empty shelves in disgust. They'd just spent most of a day carefully removing debris and shoring up portions of the building, trying to make it safe enough to enter. Now they were finally in the supermarket, the part that hadn't been flattened anyway, only to find that the shelves had been cleaned out. Every can, every package of food was gone. There were footprints all over the place inside, but there had been no indication outside the building of how they had gotten in.
Chavez will have a stroke, Timmonson thought.
Again? We've been beaten to it again?
Chavez was, as expected, not taking it well. The corporal, when angry, got very quiet, and this made the other soldiers more nervous than a good old-fashioned cussing out would have. Soldiers jockeyed to position themselves behind their fellows so as not to be in immediate view. Chavez took a deep breath and fought for control.
Whoever this group is, they have some technique or something that we don't. More important, though, they're taking supplies that we need in order to keep our civilian charges alive. We are not keeping up with needs, and I'm tired of it. As of now, we're on a looter hunt, weapons hot, and if you happen to shoot one or two of them, I'm not going to notice. Clear?
Chavez glared around at the soldiers before continuing.
You see anyone, and I mean anyone, you take them into custody. If they aren't part of this group we're looking for and they aren't looting, we can apologize and let them go. But no one gets away without scrutiny.
64. Winging it. August 8th. No wonder our account balance was going down so fast. Richard stood, arms akimbo, staring at one of two ultralight kits. The other kit had been opened and was halfway to becoming an actual aircraft. A half dozen people were milling around, looking at instructions, arguing, and generally getting in each other's way.
I resent the implication, Bill replied. Anyway, we never got around to paying for a lot of things I'd ordered. Yellowstone kind of interrupted the billing cycle, if you know what I mean. If civilization ever does resume, we might have to do an extra gold mining expedition or two just to get caught up on payments.
Unfucking believable. Richard tried to keep a straight face, but a grin kept breaking through.
So, do you know how to fly one?
I've taken lessons, but don't have a lot of hours. A couple of these guys, though?
Bill indicated the group that was attempting to construct the aircraft.
Are experienced pilots. One of them has an instrument rating, and several do gliders as well. I think we're covered.
Richard smiled.
I noticed someone out with the Bobcat this morning plowing up an area outside the fence. That's your doing, I guess?
Bill shrugged, palms up.
Runway. Gotta have one.
Is there a point, though?
Not really sure yet, Richard.
They might be more useful earthside once all the crap is out of the air.
Maybe we can get out to Omaha and scavenge that distributor's warehouse. Here? Maybe for scouting out herds or something? I like having the capability just in case.
Fine, okay, Orville. But don't kill yourself, all right? Can we get that thing through the truck gate fully assembled?
Way ahead of you, big guy, Bill said. We measured, and yes, we can, sideways. Actually, we've been talking about visiting the airport at some point and seeing if there's anything small we can salvage.
There should be a number of small planes,
a woman on the assembly crew added.
Once it's safe to fly again Earthside, we can start searching for survivors, or even maybe make it to some outpost of civilization.
Bill gestured toward the speaker. Helen here kept her family, Cessna, at the airport. I think she's hoping hers will be in one piece.
Good thinking. Keep me in the loop.
With that, Richard turned and walked away.
And done.
Goro Yoshida slapped the airframe. He was one of their licensed pilots. It had been an offhand comment of his at one of the SciTech meetings that had reminded Bill about the ultralights. Goro had been bemoaning the likelihood that he'd never fly again, and Bill had done an immediate facepalm.
All checked out?
Bill asked, walking around the aircraft.
Ready to fly, boss man. I pulled the lucky straw, so I'll be piloting.
Cool. Just a short proving flight, then come back. We'll refuel and I'll go up with you.
You got it, Goro said.
It looks like the Bobcat's finished flattening the runway, one of the crews said.
The group very carefully opened up the construction fence and moved the ultralight out of the protected area. Guards stood around with shotguns just in case. Once through, they moved to the runway. Goro did the required pre-flights, even though he'd done the same checks 20 minutes earlier, then climbed aboard and started it up.
Nice and quiet, he said to Bill.
Bill gestured toward the engine.
I never could stand the noisy ones that sound like lawnmowers. I made sure I ordered a model that advertised a low decibel rating.
He stepped back and motioned to Goro to take off. Goro gave him a thumbs up and taxied down the runway. The ultralight needed very little space to get aloft, and within seconds, Goro was circling Rivendell. People stopped what they were doing and pointed. The sound of cheers drifted up from the spectators. After a few minutes, Goro landed. They refueled and rechecked. Then Bill and Goro climbed in. The takeoff took only a little more runway with two people. As they did the obligatory circuit around Rivendell, Bill got his first chance to see Pleistocene, Nebraska, from the air.
Holy crap on a cracker.
Bill was sure he was gawking like a tourist, but didn't care. Nebraska, in Outland, was hillier than Earthside, as Aaron had pointed out more than once. It also had a lot more trees, although not anywhere near the dense forest typical of the West Coast. The trees were mostly deciduous, with what looked like maple, oak, and birch dominating, with maybe some pine and cedar here and there. The important thing was to get a good overview of the land within a 5-mile radius or so. Bill had instructed Goro to spiral outward for as long as fuel allowed. Bill took picture after picture with the tablet, frequently adding voice annotations. He noted clear, flat areas for farming, hillier, open areas for grazing, and groves of trees that looked large enough to be able to handle a partial harvest. One of the principles that the new colony had already laid down was that they would not raise the environment like a cloud of locusts. Bill's reverie was broken by a muttered comment from Goro.
Hey, Bill. Remember we talked about birds?
He gestured to their left.
Pigeons.
Bill looked in the indicated direction, and sure enough, an enormous cloud of birds was bearing down on them.
Passenger pigeons. I'm beginning to understand why our forefathers wiped them out. Rats with wings doesn't even begin to describe it. Can you dive under them?
You can't dive in an ultralight, damn it, Goro exclaimed as he wrestled with the controls. Not if you want to stay in the air. On the other hand, Goro pulled the nose up and turned toward the flock while opening the throttle wide open.
The sudden noise from the engine and the rapid approach registered with the flock as a potential attack. In moments, the cloud of pigeons was breaking for the horizon.
So, not all fun and games,